more of our colleagues on the Senate side. Why don't we begin with a continuance of the public hearing on Senate Bill 5520, the Department of Justice budget. And Mr. Boss, if you would like to come forward and continue on Civil Enforcement Division.
Mr. Chair, members, there should be a tab in your yellow-faced notebook for Civil Enforcement Division.
Ready when you are. All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss, and I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice, and I am here to provide you an overview of the Civil Enforcement Division today. If you can take a look at page one of the section on civil enforcement, you can see that the Civil Enforcement Division is primarily the Civil Plaintiff Trial Division at the Department of Justice. It sues to obtain money or to enforce the law in civil court. So you've heard from the Trial Division, that is primarily our defense counsel, and you've heard from the Criminal Division, which handles the criminal cases. We handle the civil plaintiff work for the Department of Justice and for the State of Oregon. We do have one section, which I will talk about later. It's the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit that does some bit of criminal prosecutions strictly related to Medicaid fraud. Turning to page two, we have an overview of the organization of the Civil Enforcement Division. It is arranged into five sections, which are broken out into practice groups, and I will talk about each of the practice groups later. It is the second largest legal division in the Department of Justice with 138 positions. It's located in three cities, in Portland, Salem, and Eugene. The lower half of the page, you can see that the budget is $37.5 million for this upcoming biennium, governor's recommended budget. On page three, we can see the budget history, which is maintained fairly level. I would note that in the 2003-05 session, the general funding for our financial fraud consumer protection section was suspended. And I will talk about that when I talk about the finances for the financial fraud consumer protection section. I'd like first to address the civil recovery section. The budget drivers for that section are bad economic times. This section handles the suing for money owed for state agencies. It also handles the bankruptcies or represents the state in bankruptcy court. So bad economic times would cause a default in obligations to the state, and this section would come in either bankruptcy court or filing lawsuits litigating to recover for obligations owed to the state. This section is also responsible for the protection of the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement revenue. That's revenue that comes in approximately $120 to $150 million per biennium that comes in from the Master Settlement Agreement with the large tobacco companies. I have a policy option package in this area, and I will discuss in more detail what the ramifications of the Master Settlement Agreement. This section also handles cost recovery litigation. Many state agencies, when they expend money primarily to clean up or to undertake a project, they can sue a responsible party to recover for the costs of that action. An example is the Department of Forestry. If there is a forest fire that is human-caused, the Department of Forestry is allowed to bill, and then if there's no payment, to litigate and to sue a responsible party who started the fire. This section does that type of work for the Department of Forestry, for Department of Administrative Services, for DEQ, and for many other agencies that will have similar cost recovery type statutes. The services provided by the section, this is at the bottom of page 4, like I stated, it primarily sues for money owed to state agencies. It protects the flow of tobacco funds into the state, and it litigates for cost recovery actions. Another example of cost recovery would be the New Carissa lawsuit. You can remember the New Carissa wash ashore in, on the spit of Coos Bay. The it was on Department of State Lands land, and the state sued in order to remove the Rusty Hulk from the beach, and we received a $25 million jury verdict in that case. Turning to page 5, one thing we do track in this section is the amount of monies recovered to the state. We average between $25 and $30 million per biennium. This is actual money.
Mr. Chair, can I ask you a quick question?
Certainly.
On that $25 million, do you get to keep one-third? That's right.
I talked about it with the Attorney General.
actually, it's a serious question. Where does that entire $25 million go?
The $25 million is currently in dispute and is in our client trust account. The funds would eventually, and we're working on a settlement to settle, it's now at the appellate court level. Those funds would go to the Division of State Lands, and I believe the Division of State Lands has went to the e-board and received permission to use up to $18 million to remove the New Carissa from the spit.
Okay, so not a cent would go to DOJ then?
Correct. Okay. Other than our regular billings throughout the period of time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
The through the end of December, this unit has recovered $23 million for the state. I expect fully that it will recover at least $30 million through this biennium, and that that is exclusive of the New Carissa settlement, which I anticipate, which may come in this biennium. So it may be up to $50 million for the recovery for this biennium. We do have a performance measure in this area. It's KPM 137-3. Which measures the efficiency of the unit. For example, if we look at the graphs for the year 2006, the state recovered $17.88 for every dollar expended. If you can see our target here, we're still working with this particular performance measure, and I don't think we've hit the proper target yet. Some years it's been low, and some years it's obviously our recoveries have been well in excess of the $8.37 that we've set for the target. I think we need a little bit more experience with this before we can set a proper target.
Yes.
Chair Shields.
Is that primarily because you have windfall cases that are you can't anticipate coming down the pike?
Chair Shields, correct. And once a case reaches a certain size, you put in the same amount of effort to a $3 million case as you would for a $5 million case. So when you have large cases, sometimes it may or may not actually reflect the efficiency of the unit. And so we're still struggling with that to try and find the proper target to take that into account. I anticipate we will change that upward. I just don't know where. At the top of page 6, we do have a policy option package for this section, and we have titled it the Defense of Receipts from Tobacco Master Settlement. This is a policy option package to fund the lawsuits that will recover for the Master Settlement funds that have been withheld last April, and to ensure that there are no further reduction in the payments from the Master Settlement Agreement. And at this point, I'd like to take just a few minutes to maybe lay a little bit of a foundation for this policy option package. In 1998, the vast majority of attorney generals settled their ongoing litigation with the large tobacco companies. and the resulting settlement was titled the Master Settlement Agreement. And under that Master Settlement Agreement, from that time, there have been payments of money every year from the large tobacco companies to the states, and that have been allocated out to the states. In this Master Settlement Agreement, which is about as thick as the Internal Revenue Code, there is a mechanism that allows the signatories, the tobacco companies that signed on to the tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, to set off their market share loss to those tobacco companies that did not sign on to the agreement, and from the yearly payments to the states. That mechanism has been triggered now, and as of April, the payments to the states were reduced by the amount of market share loss. The defense to that market share loss for an individual state is that they diligently enforced their non-participating manufacturer statutes that they have in place. We call them NPM statutes, or non-participating manufacturer statutes. What this requires is that if a company wants to sell tobacco products in the state of Oregon or any other state that is a signature to the MSA, that tobacco company either has to join the MSA and make the payments through the Master Settlement Agreement, or that company needs to set aside into an escrow fund the same amount of funds that would have paid under the Master Settlement Agreement. Those are what we call the NPM statutes. The diligent enforcement of the NPM statutes are what provides us a safe harbor from an adjustment under these NPM statutes, or under the NPM reductions. On the top, the slide on the top of page 6 shows why we enforce the NPM laws. And then the slide at the bottom of page 6 shows really the nature of the present dispute. And currently what has happened is in April of 2006, several of the tobacco companies withheld funds from the payments to the states. That totaled for Oregon around $9 million. We filed suit in Multnomah County Court in order to recover those funds that were withheld. The policy option package, which 201, is to provide funds for that litigation. The funds that were withheld were for the year 2003, although it was for the payment in 2006. The potential is that if we lose this litigation, if we were found to not have diligently enforced our statutes, we could lose the entire payment for 2003, which is a significant amount of money. We anticipate in the upcoming biennium that three such years will be triggered, so that every April there will be a withholding and a lawsuit or a action forced in order to recover those funds. We can turn to the next page, page 7. At the top are the MSA receipts that are going to be in question. Probably for through this biennium, it will be the 03, 04, and 05. The litigation in Multnomah County has been stayed and referred to an arbitration, as we have not been the lone state to initiate this litigation. The vast majority of our brethren have also. Almost every case, except for one, has been referred to arbitration. But we don't know what the arbitration will be, whether it will be regionally, nationally. We don't know the rules of the arbitration. So we're kind of in a state of flux. And so it's hard to pin down the exact costs and to figure out exactly what is happening. The policy package that we've asked for is for $2.5 million in general funding to finance this litigation, and for 3 FTE for the Department of Justice. The $2.5 million is primarily to pay for the cost of the special assistant attorney generals that we have working on the case in Multnomah County, and also for the cost of litigation. Our case is proven by paper, and so there are a tremendous volume of documents and exhibits that have to be organized and we have to keep track of. So there's a litigation cost for almost organizing and manipulating an evidentiary database, which has been a sizable expense. This estimate, which is truly just an estimate, is based on our practice, and we're paying, when we were in the initial phase of this litigation, between $100,000 and $150,000 per month in outside counsel litigation costs, and we paid approximately just a little under $500,000 in database and document tracking costs. This is based on an estimate that we would bring, because of just efficiency, we would bring this down to around $100,000 per month throughout this biennium.
Mr. Chair, just a couple other things on that package. Are you done with that?
Yes, except for answering questions.
I was just going to say that the legislature will still have to appropriate the remaining amounts due for the defense of this master settlement agreement for the current biennium. We've paid out roughly $1 million, a little less than $1 million, and there is still money to be paid for 05-07. That will be in a supplemental appropriation bill. And the timing on this is really, you don't know how much you're going to spend because there's so many factors. It's the court decisions in this state and every other state, the selection, if that's the case, of a national arbitrator, how fast it moves, ongoing negotiations with tobacco companies. So there's a big unknown. It will probably be our recommendation as LFO to put whatever amount is decided in as a special appropriation emergency board and have them come back to the e-board to get the funding.
Senator Wessel.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, I appreciate Doug's words. I think it's also appropriate to put this in the context of an ROI, return on investment analysis, prudent man rule. This is as we all know, a very fluid situation with many moving interchangeable parts that, you know, we have control of very few of. But at the same time, I think it behooves us in terms of overall return to the state for us to be a consistent and frontline player in this, as I think the department is requesting. I think this is we're far from making budget judgments, but I do appreciate your point of view and your perspective.
Thank you.
One more thing, I just want to make sure. The revenue stream where these dollars generally have gone are for payment of bonds used to settle or financial crisis of 0103, as well as bonds, revenue stream for OHSU bonds. I think they're biotechnology related bonds. I can't remember the formal term. So these are going for debt service, this revenue stream, the majority of it. So the importance of the revenue stream is, if this revenue stream isn't there, it either affects the bond rating for the state or you have to kick in general fund.
Or like venture fund
or something like that. I can't remember.
My question is, Mr. Boss, how long are we going to have to incur $2.5 million in biennium in order to continue to collect the tobacco settlements? I mean, is there the end of the tunnel on this case, or is this something that will be ongoing?
Chair Shields, there are actually two answers. One is this goes on in perpetuity. The payments come in perpetuity, and the obligation remains in perpetuity. However, this particular arrangement is not working for either the states or the tobacco companies. So we are, as we speak, we are trying to settle this particular group of litigation and then the ongoing NPM reduction issue so that both sides can have a more workable arrangement. It truly has not worked for anybody. And I think there's more likely than not this will be settled. I don't know when it's going to be settled. I don't know whether we will have to go through a round of arbitration before we reach a point where we can settle. But I more likely than not, this will probably be settled.
Thanks. One second, and I'll get to your question. Mr. Wilson, do you know where the debt service to the tobacco bonds might show up in our budget? Would that be in economic development or?
Mr. Chair Kelly, do you know?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kelly Friels with the Budget Management Department of Administrative Services. I believe that shows up in our budget.
In DAS or?
DAS's budget, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
If that's not correct, Mr. Chair, I will get back to you.
Thank you. Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly understand the principle of return on investment and many of the things that are proposed to the legislature can be cast as investments, either investments in the short term or investments in long-term improvement for the state. Given that, and given that we can't necessarily fund every request that shows up in a policy package, if you didn't have this policy option package, or if this policy option package was not approved, what would happen? Would you stop pursuing this settlement? I mean, stop pursuing the money that could have come in?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, we would probably, as Kelly said, go and come back to the emergency board and explain the situation.
Rather than make a choice of resources within the agency, spending it on this rather than something else.
I don't know what we would do. We can get back with you on that. I might.
Can I answer that question?
Certainly. Oh, I can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, the agency typically in situations like this, if you would not allocate the resources and then have to redistribute within their agency, would come back to a meeting of the emergency board or maybe this special session, if that occurs, for legislative concurrence on how they would redistribute the resources, because we consider this to be a fairly major program change. So you would have, once again, an opportunity to decide whether to give them additional resources or have the existing resources redistributed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and along those same lines, members of the subcommittee, there is no one really to bill. I mean, much of their revenues are they bill an agency, and there isn't anyone to bill, so that would be you'd be taking it out of the general funded portions, which is child support, criminal justice, parts of criminal justice, and defense of criminal convictions. So there's a limited area of general fund in this agency anyways.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
We do have another policy option package that is hopefully less complicated than the tobacco, and that is on page 8, policy option package 202. In the civil recovery section, as I stated in the beginning, the part of what the civil recovery section does is cost recovery actions. We have a unit that prosecutes cost recovery actions for the Oregon Department of Transportation. The unit currently brings in around $1 million a year recovering for a cost, for example, for if someone runs into a lamppost or a guardrail, then ODOT will fix that guardrail, send a bill to the responsible driver. If the driver or the driver's insurance company is non-responsive, then this unit will handle the negotiations and if litigation is necessary, litigation. The
does appear about $2,300,000 less complicated.
Yes. And I'm pretty happy. The unit usually recovers about, for every dollar expended, $12 of recovery. It's a system based primarily on administrative specialists sending out billings and then negotiating with the insurance companies. ODOT supports this package. ODOT currently sends over more cases than we can prosecute with the existing unit of three people. We need an additional person. Then we can process these faster. For every letter we send out, we have a better chance of having a recovery. The fiscal impact is $121,000. And it affects our KPM 137-3, which is the amount of recoveries in a biennium.
Mr. Bossan, so am I missing that in here? How much you anticipate collecting for that additional 121?
It is not here, and I can give that to you.
Please continue.
The next section I'd like to address is our charitable activities section. The charitable activities section has two programs, the charities program, and the goal of the charities program is to allow Oregon to be a safe place to give to charities, and they address misleading charitable solicitations and items such as that. There's also the gaming program. Their goal is to keep charities or charitable gaming fair and competitive, so there's a licensing procedure and administration of charitable gaming. In Oregon, the Attorney General licenses and regulates all charitable organizations and activities, which is typical for a state. So the licensing and regulatory function is not in a separate agency, but is with the Attorney General. The primary services of this particular section is education, and so they aim at educating charitable organizations with literature. They provide audit services to make sure that they are on track and are complying with the rules. Also, the section educates the public. It has a website that we get over 100,000 hits per year on the website, where you can go and put in a charity, you can find out information about a charity, what percentage goes to a particular, how much of the funds that each dollar given will go to a charity. We also, charities register with the department and file their tax returns. We have an open file system, and we have 1 to 2 visitors a day that come in and just go through our paper files and find out everything they want to know about a particular charity. So that's the educational aspect. We also, audit charitable organizations. If there is a charitable foundation, a charitable trust, or a gift to a charity in a will and there is an estate, the entity that will come in and represent the charitable purpose is this section. So the Attorney General appear and make sure that the charity does get the funds that the testator wished it to get.
If I could just comment on that, Mr. Boss, I've used those services going down to check out the 990, so charitable organizations, when I was doing research on different foundations and trying to figure out where to make grants, and then as somebody who started a 501c3, I also had to register with DOJ, and the staff was always incredibly helpful, and the information was very helpful to me as well. And then in the rare instance where I didn't pay the registration on time, a reminder letter that allowed me to do that. And they were it was very helpful. I think Suzanne, I don't remember her name, but I never felt like I was penalized in an unreasonable way. For that, they were always trying to help you comply rather than hit you with the bludgeon, which was much appreciated.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Actually, that is the and they work because the staff knows that most charitable organizations are in it for a charitable purpose and they're to do good. We do have a tremendous educational effort, and we work with other nonprofits to arrange for the education of people that are involved in nonprofit areas. So,
and then lastly, I mean, it also adds a great degree of transparency to make sure that you can always go down and take a look at the charities 990, make sure that there's no self-dealing that's happening, and I know that's part of the regulations for that as well.
Yes. The workload, and I'm now on page 11, as the years have gone by, our gaming workload has decreased because of the competition on from the area, from lottery and from tribal casinos. So the primary, as you can see, the primary type of activity, well, a lot of the activity is bingo, and as bingo is facing a lot of competition from other sources. At the same time, our charities workload has increased because of the popularity of charitable organizations or trusts as a vehicle for giving. So we have, through the years, been transferring or shifting personnel from the gaming area into the charities area because the workload is slowly decreasing in gaming and increasing in the charities area. The section is completely fee-supported. There are no general funds dollars going to the program. All the fees are paid by the licensees and the registrants. We currently have Senate Bill 109, which seeks authority to increase the charitable organization fees by rule. There is one correction I'd like to make. The current fee schedule actually is adequate. We are seeking the ability to. We anticipate that perhaps sometime during this biennium or early in the next biennium, we may need to raise the fees in this area. The fees have not been raised for 20 years. Currently, they're set by statute, and we have in our Senate Bill 109, which is before Senator Burdick's committee, a bill to allow us to change that using administrative rules. That's currently what we do in gaming. So if we wish to raise the gaming fees, there again, I don't think we've raised those fees in 15 years or so, but if we wish to raise them, we would go through the administrative rule process, and so we are seeking authority to do that for the charities fees also, although there's no current plan to raise those fees. There is a performance measure here, KPM 137-6. It is the percentage of timely and complete charities reports submitted relative to the total charities registered. The goal of this particular performance measure is to measure the effect of our educational efforts. So if we feel that if we can get out there and meet with the charities, we have our educational push, that will be reflected then in their ability to timely file and to accurately file. We originally set the goal or the target at 79%. That was unfortunately using the wrong data. We had the 79% is the percentage of those timely filed, not timely and complete. So timely and complete, our target is 70%, and we have readjusted that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Was it 2005 you were late?
Neither confirm nor deny.
I would now like to turn to our family law section, which is on page 13. Our family law section has two clients, the Division of Human Services for termination of parental rights cases, and our own Division of Child Support for support order litigation. The termination of parental rights caseload has been unfortunately increasing through the years, primarily driven by the methamphetamine crisis. The uneven nature of the upward trend reflects primarily staffing changes at DHS. So all of the cases are referred over by DHS, and when they have a shortage, then they can't process the cases fast. So we have kind of an uneven nature there. The budget drivers, methamphetamine is the primary budget driver, and you can see through the years as the meth crisis has developed, so have, unfortunately, the termination of parental rights cases. Also, there are federal mandates in this area, and it's the goal of there's a lot of federal funding in the area, and it's the goal of the federal acts that if there is an adoptable child, to have that child in a stable home as soon as possible.
Representative Parker.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask if you've seen any decrease in that, in the taking the kids away since we passed the meth bill, which outlawed the home labs, home cooking labs, which that was part of the one of the things we were hoping to see an outcome of. Those kids all had to be put into foster care. Have you seen a decrease there, or is it too early to tell yet?
Chair Shields, Representative Barker, in speaking with the attorney in charge in this area, I asked that exact question in preparation for this, and she said in the last quarter of 06, they started to see a decrease in terminations, that she could point to the lack of methamphetamines, or the work that this has actually had an effect. So I anticipate that we'll see more or less what happens in this current year, and to see the real effects, if there is truly an effect.
Thank you.
Chair Shields?
Yeah, Mr. Boss. I know in Oregon, I could be mistaken, but my understanding is that if a child is taken away, they've got 1 year, the family has 1 year to get the child back, otherwise they go to permanent adoption. Does that sound about right?
Chair Shields, I don't know, but I can certainly get back to you on that.
Could you do a little digging for me to,
sure,
A, find out if that perception is correct, and mm-hmm, B, to find out if that's part of the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, or is that a policy that we've implemented statewide?
Well, Mr. Chair, or Kelly, can it is under the AFSAR, the
Adoption and Safe Family Act.
Thank you. And I think the period is 14 months, I think, but I'd have to
can't remember. It's around a year that they have from one particular point, but it is federal law. It's not state law.
Thank you.
Come on down. The next section I'd like to talk about is our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. This is a federally mandated unit. The federal mandate is that the states, in order to receive certain Medicaid funds, must have a Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. This unit prosecutes a fraud in Medicaid billing and also the abuse of patients in nursing homes. Also has a training component, training local law enforcement and other governmental agencies. The caseload has been increasing for the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. The monetary recoveries, this unit prosecutes about 50% of their cases in criminal court and the other part in civil court. Does obtain monetary recoveries that go to the Oregon Health Plan and also to the federal government on a 3-to-1 split. The funding for this section is also a matching federal grant. For every dollar that the state of Oregon puts into the funding of the section, it is matched by $3 of federal money. The budget drivers, this unit has primarily been a victim of their own success. They've had several high-profile cases, which has increased referrals from local law enforcement agencies and from other areas within the federal government.
And so, again, those funds would go into the Oregon Health Plan. DOJ doesn't get to retain any of the money they claw back.
There is this last year there was instituted a program income, actually I think before last year, there is a small element of certain recoveries that the federal government will not take a portion of their recovery and allow the Medicaid fraud unit to use the money as a matching grant or as part of the state matching money. It's called program income.
Okay. And then that would be other funds in the DOJ budget?
I do believe it would be.
Okay, thank you.
Another budget driver in this area is that these are fairly sophisticated cases involving financial records in the billing fraud area, and local law enforcement agencies just simply lack the resources and the expertise to handle this type of case, so they will refer them for prosecution to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. The final section that I'd like to talk about is our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection section. This section is the primary enforcer of the state's consumer protection laws. And with the enforcement of our consumer protection laws, we increase the consumer confidence, and we also promote competition here in Oregon. The emphasis of this section is on education, and we found that education is the best preventative, much akin to our charity section. We do enforcement when necessary. Probably a lot of you might be familiar with our educational effort. It is led by Jan Margosian, who is our consumer information coordinator. She speaks statewide to various consumer groups. She also assists constituents in any issues that they might have with various businesses. DOJ, the section, and DOJ also have a website, and on the website we post warnings and various consumer protection items. We have educational publications. We also have an online complaint form so that if anyone has a problem, they can simply go to the website, fill out a complaint form that goes into our database. We operate, or the section operates, a toll-free consumer hotline. It's operated from 8:30 to 4:30, and we have 24 volunteers that man those phones. Consumers can either have a question answered, or they can have a complaint, or they can direct it to another agency.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Westland.
24 volunteers?
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, correct.
How are they trained?
We do, Chair Shields, Senator Westland, we have a training program. They are primarily from, I believe, AARP, and we put each one that comes in through a training program on how to answer it. I believe they also have a written materials to speak from.
How long is that?
Chair Shields?
A day, a week, 6 hours?
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, I am not sure, but I can certainly get back to you.
But the point is, you're very satisfied with the quality of service that the volunteers provide, at least as a gatekeeper steering to the right.
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, yes, we are.
Maybe perhaps you wrote up a couple of sentences to get to the professional staff about what that training entails. That would be helpful. Good. Now, Mr. Boss, we're 3:45. I'm not sure how long the other two sections would be. Are we on time or running a little bit? Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Right. Good. Fire away.
I'm very close to an end. The on page 19, we can see the funding for this section. In 2003, in the 03-05, general fund was suspended. There was, as you can see from our bar graph, a general fund component up until 03-05. It is now entirely self-funded by case settlements. The case settlement, the funding is fine for the current, or for the 07-09 biennium. However, we anticipate that we cannot keep this model going forever, that our expenditures are rising. And we, although we had an excellent biennium for recoveries in 05-07, we do not anticipate that going on forever. So at some point in time, not this for this biennium, but maybe next biennium or the biennium after, we will be coming back with a request for general funding for the section. Each year, In the bottom part of that page, 19, each year the Attorney General publishes the top 10 areas of complaints or contracts. This shows the trends. And turning to the last page, shows the trends of complaints that are coming into the section. These are one of the areas in which the section does source of its work is we have consumer complaints that we tally, we see the trends, and we then go and address the problems that might be in that particular industry. We also receive referrals from other state agencies, and then we work with other states in the multi-state areas where there are some of these issues, such as pharmaceuticals or the West Coast electricity pricing and supply issue, are more of a multi-state area. And on the bottom of page 20 shows how we work the cases in that particular section.
Senator Parker.
Thank you. If I could ask you, if you're seeing a trend, I see you have Nigerian. I have several emails from the general or general's widow that needs help getting her money. But I just was reading where there's a new scam, and I wondered if this hit Oregon yet, where the people are going into the job search sites and finding people who are looking for work. And they're sending them checks saying, you know, you need to help me do this. You get a 10% cut for moving the money. So then I go to the bank with my checks that are forgeries and are counterfeit. Cash those in, send them 10%. Of course, then I get arrested for aiding and abetting in a crime scheme to help somebody else make all this money. Are we seeing that one in Oregon yet? Or
Chair Shields, Representative Barker, I have not seen that one yet.
That's nationally, so you might want to. They're getting people will actually take those in cash and or, you know, deposit them and then write them a check out of their account. And, of course, soon after that, it's discovered.
You can still corner the market on that.
Yeah.
Representative Nathan.
Money for nothing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very interested in the topic of consumer complaints, and I noticed that there are a few places where bars are missing. Is that because there's just not data yet for that time period, or there's not going to be data?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, that can mean one of two things. There is not data in that particular area, or that did not rise to top 10.
That the numbers were low enough that okay.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. My question was along those lines, too, because I get just dozens of these Nigerian things. And so the absence of a bar, have you taken, and I used to send all of them to Jan Margosian. Poor Jan. She needs a raise because of me. But have you taken any kind of unusual action on the Nigerian piece of it that might be showing results here?
Chair Shields, Senator Burdick, for our normal response in the Nigerian, when we receive a Nigerian inquiry, is to tell the person, don't do anything, delete the email, whatever you do, don't send that person any money. For a period of time, we were not keeping statistics on the Nigerian inquiries because it was so overwhelming. We've started doing it again, but the reason that it's not there is that we just simply didn't. We got so overwhelmed, and there wasn't really any enforcement action the section could take because it was an email from abroad, other than to educate the consumer to not do it.
Senator Wessling.
I think, if I'm interpreting body language correctly from staff, that the lack of bars behind Nigerian and construction contractors is a technical glitch in the programming. It's incorrect body language interpreting.
Could you say that for the record?
When it does not show up in the second year, it doesn't rise. Yes. It had been in the past on the top 10, and it just simply does not rise yet this year or in that particular year to the level of the top 10.
Really? Construction contractors aren't in the top 10 this year?
I believe so.
I stand corrected, folded.
All right. I suppose that's good news. Shocking. Good news. Great.
That concludes.
Thank you very much. Anything else?
Thank you. That's it.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Testimony. Turn around and we lose our quorum. We are going to move into the work session for the Department of Justice federal grant. This shouldn't take very long. So I will open a... I need to open the new sub. We
should probably bring the whole sub back.
Yes, okay. I will open a regular subcommittee meeting on Public Safety Joint Committee Ways and Means, and we will open a work session on the Department of Justice federal grants. And colleagues, as you may know, during legislative session when the department is going to apply for a federal grant, they need to come to Ways and Means for approval. This particular grant has already been submitted, but so they're just coming to get authorization that if they get the money, they can use it. So if you would like to tell us a little bit about the grant and its purposes and tie that into the DOJ's mission, that'd be...
Thank you, Chair Shields. For the record, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the Director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section for the Department of Justice. Happy to see you all again. The grant is applying to the U.S. Department of Justice Office for Justice Programs Bureau of Justice Assistance Protecting Inmates and Safeguarding Communities Program. And this grant is meant to work hand-in-hand with an already existing grant at the Department of Corrections that is working on implementation of the Prison Rape Elimination Act. This grant is through the Oregon Department of Justice. When seeking application for this grant, it was our understanding that the grant committee would look more favorably upon the grant if it went through a state agency, which speaks to statewide collaboration and farther-reaching effects of the grant. So because of our association with the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, we agreed to apply for this grant on behalf of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. So this grant essentially does two things. It provides much-needed equipment and infrastructure for Multnomah County Sheriff's Office in the form of technology that will allow staff to better track inmate activities in the hopes that it would reduce incidents of inmate upon inmate sexual assaults and staff on inmate sexual assaults in the facility. It's my understanding that the Multnomah County facilities are pretty old, and there are kind of pockets where sight lines are not good, and so this money would serve to help that problem. And then the second part of the grant would provide sustainable training for what is essentially a culture change in the corrections community in Oregon regarding prison rape, and would provide training on sexual assault and how to prevent sexual assault, how to report sexual assault, and the dynamics around sexual assault in a prison environment. So this, again, this grant goes hand-in-hand with a grant that is from the same funding source granted to the Department of Corrections, I believe in October of 2006, and that grant was largely for infrastructure for the Department of Corrections facilities. There was some money, I understand, for some computer programs. They were tracking things on paper, so some computer programming. A very small amount of money for training, and then a staff person for those activities in DOC. This grant will fill some of the gaps, mainly the training grant that was the training part of the project that was not addressed in that initial grant, and is felt as really crucial for this kind of culture change within corrections in Oregon.
Representative Barker.
I'm not sure when you talk about culture change, you're talking about the corrections people or the prisoners?
Chair Shields, Representative Barker, both, but really among staff in recognizing that sexual assault in prisons is not something to be accepted in, as a norm for inmates. That's my understanding.
And I think, you, as you were saying, the corrections people, in fact, I just gave Chairman Shield a little video or a little CD of the video. They show new prisoners coming into Coffee Creek, giving them some warnings about what to avoid as a prisoner, how to stay out of that, and then how to report it if there is an assault. And I thought it was a kind of a nice little program, trying to explain to the victim that they're not, what they're, you know, like we do all victims of sexual assault. It's not their fault. How to handle it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be for a 24-month term project or program. But you mentioned culture change. So my question is the expectation that although the money in this project, at least in theory, ceases at the end of 2 years, that there is a permanent, noticeable change?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, the purpose of the grant is to provide solid curriculum that can be disseminated, used through, I believe, 6 trainings throughout the life of the grant, but then also used to train people within Department of Corrections to further that training so that it would actually live on past the 24 months. And if there were a need for more funding, then there would be application to probably to the same program again for further funding. But it's the hope that with a good curriculum, which often includes written and PowerPoint materials and perhaps a train-the-trainer component, that effort will live on.
Thank you.
Ms. Stinson, my question would be around the key performance measures. I know this isn't exactly the core business of DOJ, but if you could help us report back to the Ways and Means of what, if any, key performance measures this might have some bearing on, we sure would appreciate that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Chair Shields, it is kind of an unusual program as far as our key performance measures are concerned. As you might recall from my testimony last week, the key performance measures for the crime victims assistance section are pretty specific to our compensation program and our grants program. However, one key performance measure it might fit with is the number of sexual assaults exams done by SANE nurses. I suppose that may fit in some small amount, but it really speaks more to the Oregon State benchmarks of public safety, I believe, than our kind of narrow, specific key performance measures at the Crime Victims Assistance Section.
Thank you very much. Questions? All right. Let's get our strange senator in here. Ben, how do you vote?
I've been following this discussion very closely.
First, let's see if anybody has any discussion about this grant proposal that Department of Justice is putting in on prevention of prisoner rape.
I'm just starting to say I think that's a really good, positive step, something that's obviously necessary.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
And this is on a report back to the subcommittee?
Say again?
This is on a report.
No, this is a grant proposal that DOJ has put in. We just need to pass it in full Ways and Means.
With a due pass.
Yeah. Any objections? So we will approve this grant application. I'll need a carrier to take it to full Ways and Means. Representative Nathanson, would you be interested in doing that for me? Thank you very much. And Mr. Wilson will help you with your pony. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Chair Shields, if I might, just as a follow-up from my testimony last week, Senator Brown asked about outcome measures for our grant program, and I do have copies of those documents here. I wonder if I might leave them.
Please, yeah, I think we'd all be interested in seeing that.
Thank you.
Was this not even a retroactive grant approval?
Actually, it is.
It is.
Oh. We had to have some controversy.
They met the 10-day requirement.
Yeah, okay.
Good. All right, so we're almost 4:05. Then if we can then discuss Administrative Services Division. Is it Frank Pachia? Pasha? Yes. Okay. Thanks. We're will open a public hearing on the original bill, Senate Bill 5520, Department of Justice. Thank you very much. Good eye. Ready when you are, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Frank Pecha, Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Justice. I can see that time is running by rather quickly, and from prior sessions I realize that things get delayed, so I'm going to try and get through this as quickly as I can so Karen can come up and talk about the billing rate. So I'll probably, if there's any questions, please don't hesitate to stop me, and but I will try and move rapidly through this for you.
If there are any questions, please don't hesitate to refrain from asking them.
Our mission is to contribute to the success of the department's programs. You heard from two folks, Cindy Stinson and Fred Boss, both one a program manager, another an administrator. Our responsibility is to ensure that those folks are able to do their job. In real-world terms, we attempt to provide reliable, accurate, timely, and efficient service. Page one of our handout. On page two, under organizational structure, you'll see that we're divided into five functional areas. These are the normal five functional areas that you'll find in most large agencies as far as distribution of work. The second slide down talks about the governor's recommended budget. We are approximately 6% of the budget of the Department of Justice, about $22 million. Looking at page three, the budget drivers, first thing I'd like to bring up or talk to specifically would be on the lower bottom slide. There are two specific areas I'd like to mention. One of them is that we have 28 different facilities and locations statewide. Trying to position our staff within their areas, some of our divisions, specifically the Child Support Division, needs to be in areas where people can physically get to them on bus routes in locales throughout the state. That makes us go outside and work with private landlords in order to obtain facilities for them to be in. On the other hand, we have facilities for legal staff, major offices in Portland, and we have a number of buildings in Salem, and we also have a building in Eugene for legal staff. Keeping all these an adequate size for the flexing of a large organization as it either increases or decreases within the program areas is something that's a real challenge to do. The other part that I would mention would be in budget drivers, the increase in special funded programs. In 2003-05 biennium, we had 13 special programs. In the current biennium, we have 26. Now, the key point for those is that, as Fred just talked about today, Fred Boss, our Administrator for Civil Enforcement Division, each one of those special funded programs, he depends upon us to help him figure out what is his budget, what is his forecast, to help him assess projections. So each additional program that we have like that requires additional service for each one of our program managers to be able to give them the proper assistance that they need in order to manage the program effectively to accomplish the goals that they have set forth. The budget driver graph that's at the top of page three covers an eight-year period from 1998 through 2006. There is a 77% increase in accounting transactions. A lot of this will relate to that increase in special programs that we have, but also due to the fact in that one large year from 2003 and 2004, that is when the child support program was transferred from DHS to the Department of Justice, and as such, then we started processing all the transactions for the child support program. On page four, the top graph shows our budget history. what I'd like to point out there is between the 03-05 and the 05-07 biennium, you see that there's a climb, a further increase in the graph. That is the result of the information services positions that were associated with the Division of Trial Support, which is kind of a historical group that was part of it when the child support program was under the Department of Human Services. And so the consolidation of the information services folks that were associated with the child support program, blending them in with the information services people that were already in Administrative Services Division, resulted in that budget moving up. There were no additional positions added to cause that to happen, merely the consolidation of people from another division. I'm going to briefly talk about our five operating divisions and maybe highlight just a couple of things. I'm sorry, our five operating sections. Facilities operations is an area that covers our facilities management. As I mentioned earlier, facilities is really a large workload for us. We have about 350,000 square feet in those 28 different locations. Approximately 88,000 of that is with DAS and 275,000 is with private vendors. Another part that I'd like to highlight, which is a bit unusual for an agency, is that we have library services. Library services are the direct result of having the state's largest law firm. We have attorney general opinions, we have publications, and those are sought after by members of the bar, by large law firms, and by the public in general. And so upon request and payment, we mail out the publications to various people. And we fill about 5,000 orders each biennium for that type of thing. Fiscal services, which covers generally the normal amount of accounts payable, processing, cash receipts. I'm on page 5 on the bottom. I'm sorry if I'm going a little faster. What I'd like to bring up there is the cash management, accounting, and reporting for 26 special programs and grants. Our staff there has to monitor federal programs for compliance and ensure that federal reporting requirements are met for any of these programs that are federal. There's always a significant amount of paperwork and reporting that goes along with federal programs. Another area that's in fiscal services that I wanted to highlight that's unique to the Department of Justice is that this particular section manages the department's legal billings to state agencies. And this is also an area where we have a performance measure. Performance measure 137-5. I'm on page 6 now. Deals with the collection of accounts receivable within 30 days. Our target is 80%. We're approximately at about 74% to 75%. We issue about 3.8 million currently in billings on a monthly basis. A single large agency can cause us to be below our 30-day target because of the volume of bills. Although what is difficult on the other side of the coin for a large agency, the monthly billings include hundreds of different matters. For instance, take for example DHS. Such a large organization, the number of their bill when it was paper stood about like this. It was about 4 inches thick. And as a result, the agencies have to assign the cost to the correct program or grant, in which case, by the time that paperwork follows through, it's beyond the 30-day time frame for them to pay us and have us meet our 30-day collection of receivables. What we're doing to help alleviate some of this or to streamline the process of issuing bills to client agencies is that we're using electronic billing, and we're hoping to reduce the time it takes agencies to distribute the billing to the appropriate areas within their agency and thus speed the bill review and approval process. That follows right in with my bullet number two under fiscal services efficiencies. Currently, we've got 48% of our clients that now receive their billings electronically. This has been something that we've been encouraging all of them to do. It allows them to move that billing just through their computer, just at the click of a couple of buttons to the appropriate areas, and then that allows for this increased speed in processing and helping us move towards getting up to our 80% target for collecting our receivables within 30 days. Two other areas that we also have used some innovation in fiscal services is Fred Boss answered a question, I think, or had mentioned the DOJ client trust account. Each large law firm has a client trust account where monies are kept until there is an order for disbursement. We also have one of those, and the requirement on a client trust account is that interest has to be calculated on each and every segment that's inside that account. And so this historically has been something that we have done manually, and it's quite labor-intensive. We have automated this process now so that this is done electronically, and the process takes minutes instead of days. Also, the electronic transfer of client billing information also needs to enter the state accounting system. This used to be a manual input, and we've saved a few days off our monthly processes by making this an electronic transfer as well. This has enabled us, by these series of improvements, to use the same staff to process more billings as more and more matters and more clients within the specific agencies give us work. So this has enabled us to stabilize our workforce, basically, and produce higher volume with the same staff. The human resources is another section that's real typical in admin services division. The point that I'd like to make here is with Department of Justice, we actually have three union contracts, SEIU. We also have two small groups, the CIA, which is a criminal investigators union, and OAJA, which is the Association of Justice Attorneys. Human Resources is responsible for interpreting each of those contracts and advising managers on each and every one of them. I'm on page 8 now. I'd like to just briefly mention on the bottom slide, budget services. This is a section that we are consolidating and making budget services and have pulled it out of fiscal services. Historically, the Department of Justice budget was done by fiscal personnel who are part of the fiscal section. We did not have a budget group that did nothing but budget. They were part of fiscal as a larger group. The agency's growth, complexity, size of programs have brought us to the point where we need to separate, have backup, have a proper mix of folks there that can handle the budget and provide the service to the different administrators and program managers throughout the agency. This we're able to do by doing this and creating this core group of folks. One of the key things that this group is responsible, and Karen will follow me, is the calculation of a legal billing rate. That is a prime responsible, one of the key responsibilities of this group, and other than forecasting and planning services, which they will provide to all of the program managers themselves. The last section I'd like to briefly mention is information services. Two points I'd like to bring up there, and that is, number one, that we partner and work collaboratively with the Department of Administrative Services in a number of areas. Enterprise IT strategy, our CIO is a member of the steering committee on standards and initiatives on the CIO Council and the CIO Management Council. One of the specific difficulties in IS and our environment is that we have a very broad base of types of applications that you have to know in order to service us. we have mainframe applications that are for the child support program, or what's called a CSIS program. We have specific law software that deals with the fact that we run a law firm. And then you have a variety of small programs that deal with some of the ongoing small programs within the division or within the agency, as in civil enforcement, in charities and gaming. Altogether, there are 82 applications that our ISOs have to manage and monitor within DOJ. Policy Option Package 101 is the only policy package we have. It deals specifically with, I had mentioned, regarding our budget services. It is for a budget services manager position and a fiscal analyst 3. Our budget structures, I mentioned, that was a consolidation of fiscal support and budget, is a structure from 1990 when the agency was considerably smaller and the budget was much less complex. Since then, the budget has grown 85% and the reporting has increased substantially. During 03-05 and 05-07, we covered our need in this area by using temporary positions, limited duration positions, double fill positions, which are really just stopgap measures, and we need to solidify this so we can get some stability in this work group area. Policy package 490 and 491 are companion packages, and I'm actually going to ask our budget management representative, Kelly Friels, to speak to those, but first I would like to just cover policy package 492, which is on the very last page, and this package brings the budget in line with the positions, some positions that were reclassified due to the consolidation of IS when we brought IS positions from the Child Support Division, brought them into our total organization. There was some review by Human Resources, and a few of the positions were reclassified. This action completes the final integration of those Child Support Program IT functions into the Central Department Technology Support Organization.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Fields with the Department of Administrative Services. I'm going to start with package 491 on page 11. And both 491 and 490 are essentially technical changes that the Department of Administrative Services asks this department to put together for accounting purposes. Presently, the department, when they bill their indirect charges to each of the indirect administrative charges to each of their divisions, they use a term called reduction of expense to reduce those charges. That is atypical for agencies like this. We're asking them to fully account for these charges. What the result is in this budget is it double counts the administrative costs. So you'll see $20 million as the administrative cost for Frank's sections, and then in each of the divisions, the cost will also show up as $20 million. And we have presently four other agencies that have this same situation, and it increases the budget with all of it together about $500 million, which we reduce for our purposes in determining what the total cost of the state is. And package 490 is just what the effect would be of this practice, assuming that the package that Frank talked about, package 101, is approved, and the cost of that package distributed out to each of the individual program areas. And I'd be happy to answer questions about these two packages if you'd like.
I think we might have a couple. So my understanding is that the change in accounting practices will result in a $23 million change.
Increase their expenditure limitation, Mr. Chair, by $23 million. It won't increase the amount of revenues this budget is going to be requiring.
And just in the administration, not in the other aspects of the DOJ budget?
Actually, Mr. Chair, it will affect each of the divisions of the department. So if you look down on page 11, you can see that in Pellet, for instance, under the old methodology, they would have had about $1.5 million of expense related to their administrative costs, and they would have used a reduction of expense and not shown that in their budget. Under the present methodology, we would ask them to show that as a true cost or a full cost of what the program, the administrative cost of the program.
I think I understand. Maybe somebody else can ask questions about this.
I dare you.
Mr. Chair, as a clarification, there isn't, the result of this package is there is no net increase in the resources spent by state government. It just shows up as an accounting change, and it's a double accounting. So they will not bill an agency twice for the same expenditures. They'll only deal it once. It's really an accounting within the agency that I believe the controller's office and DAS, as well as the BAM folks.
That is correct. It's an issue of consistency, trying to get agencies that do business the same to have the same accounting procedures.
And will this happen? Will this happen in an ongoing fashion, or is this just a one-time adjustment?
No, this will be included in their budget in the future.
Okay. Any questions about that? Let's continue.
I promise we're not spending another buck. That's the big thing I was worried about. That's the conclusion of my presentation. Are there any questions for me?
I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I think given the time that I think it'd be best to continue the public hearing on this bill 5520 until tomorrow. Oops, I'm getting a shaking head no.
Would it be difficult for you to come back, Karen?
No.
And
the five or seven.
Do you think?
Well, there may be questions, Mr. Chair, also, because I know I've heard. I would rather make sure folks understand this, because it does affect every budget and state government that they charge, and I want to make sure folks understand how it's built.
Yes.
And you will be asked to work session the legal rate a little in a few weeks, most likely, to give them guidance on what they should be charging.
Fair enough. And Mr. Attorney General, we apologize for making you come back for your concluding comments. We thank you for your patience on that.
And just a couple other announcements, Mr. Chair. DPSST, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, will start their hearing as soon as DOJ is done tomorrow. Then on Wednesday, there is a field trip or tour of the facility, the DPSST facility scheduled. There will be transportation provided out in front of the Capitol at 2:45 on Wednesday, or you can drive out on your own. And we can give you directions. It's relatively easy to find, and we would expect you to be back sometime around 4:30 on Wednesday if you take the agency-provided transportation. And then on Thursday, we'll be finishing up the DPSST budget, including public testimony on their budget.
And it'll be some time before we actually go to work session on the entire DOJ budget.
Right. Mr. Chair, if I can highly recommend the DPSST tour, I'm sure you've all seen the targets by now that are in offices around the building. That's from target practice at the firing range, which is a lot of fun. Yeah. And even more fun is driving the cars around in the skid cars as they train the officers. Judiciary Committee went out. I think House Judiciary went out.
We did this the past Friday. It is a facility that should be seen.
Yeah.
If it's not the best in the country, it must be awful close to it. It's really
yeah,
nice.
It's very impressive.
I heard a rumor that Representative Barker put my picture on his bullseye.
No, instead of shield, it was my picture.
Oh, was that it?
Yeah, Mr. That's Chair.
It's a good example of gun control. Tight groups.
One other item. In front of you should be some performance measures. They replace the performance measure sheet that is underneath the special tabs behind the second yellow piece of paper in the DOJ budget. And then that's it for this.
All right. Any other comments? This meeting is adjourned.